For WHUS Stores, FM 91.7, I'm Dori Smith in the Public Affairs Department. We will be speaking to Dar Jamail by phone in Turkey, where he kindly agreed to analyze breaking news and information out of Iraq for us today. Beginning last Saturday, U.S. forces used planes, tanks, and helicopter gunships in western Iraq. U.S. troops were also said to be, quote, clearing villages along the Euphrates River. The immediate response to the U.S. attacks has been an increase in car bombings in Baghdad and Tikrit, where at least 33 died, and in the town of Hawija, where at least 30 were killed. 61 people are said to have died and 124 wounded in 5 separate bombings. And this just in this afternoon, a U.S. military spokesman said militants in Iraq were mounting about 70 attacks per day, according to AP. A regional governor, Raja Nawaf Farhan al-Mahalawi, has been kidnapped, and the BBC's Jim Muir in Baghdad suggests the insurgency appears to be gathering pace rather than running out of steam. A caption beneath a photograph of a U.S. soldier in the air above Iraq states, quote, "The U.S. still appears to know little about the insurgents." Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld has avoided questions about who the resistance fighters are. But are these attacks escalating now in response to the U.S. offensive they are calling Operation Matador? Is it possible we are seeing the Fallujah model, something our guest suggested as a possibility for wider Iraq? Dar, what is your analysis of the situation today?
Well, what we know for sure is that there are fighters in that area, and the U.S. has launched a major operation to go after them, as you said, but we already have very many conflicting reports. The U.S. military claimed yesterday to have killed 100 fighters, but even that statement was contradicted by a military commander himself who said, we've, quote, killed a couple of dozen. And civilians on the ground are saying the same thing in that area, that people there are likening it to a mini version of what happened in Fallujah as far as, again, extremely heavy-handed tactics being used by the military and collective punishment in an effort to try to get just a handful of resistance fighters.
I'd like to know from your perspective whether or not there's also a similarity in your mind to these reports of Zarqawi's movements. They're saying two different things at once here, Dar. One is that Zarqawi and his fighters have moved out of the cities and toward the western province. The other is that attacks are continuing in the cities, and that those fighters attacking in the cities are not being described. So talk about these two contrasting portraits we're getting of the violence in Iraq.
Well, one thing I should make really clear is there has been a very consistent pattern with this Zarqawi person from the beginning. If we remember back to the November siege of Fallujah, the military stated that one of their goals of that siege was to get Zarqawi. So they said he was in the city, and then shortly after the siege began, he somehow managed to slip through this extremely tight military cordon around the city and escape. And then a similar thing occurred with Ramadi. They said when they were going to launch some smaller operations, but similar operations in Ramadi, they said that it was because Zarqawi was there, and then he mysteriously slipped away and then popped up in Mosul just before, again, huge military operations were launched in Mosul. And now he is once again popped up in western Iraq in more desert areas another convenient excuse to launch yet another large military siege in that area as well. So it has been a very consistent pattern, and that is in direct contradiction of the fact that the U.S. military has never given any hard evidence of his existence. This is a person who was even reported killed by a mainstream outlet in the U.S. last spring in northern Iraq, so we don't even really know for sure if this individual exists. And another example is that people in Fallujah, I've yet to meet one person in or outside of Fallujah who said that they've seen this person or anyone affiliated with him operating in Iraq, not to discount the fact that there are definitely terrorist activities going on in Iraq now, but there simply hasn't been any hard evidence provided by the military military, or any of these statements by the military being checked by mainstream media outlets in the U.S.
We've heard too that there have been attacks sort of within the same period of time in Baghdad, to Crete, and other places, with as many as 61 people killed and many more wounded. This is 5 separate bombings. And we also are hearing that a regional governor from the western part of Iraq has also been kidnapped. Dart, talk a little bit about how this violent process works interactively. We've seen, again, going back to 2004, that the violence sort of went tit for tat with the U.S. incursions in the Fallujah region, and then the U.S. leveling of Fallujah, followed again by an increase in car bombings and other kinds of attacks that we really haven't seen an end to yet. And now it seems as though we're seeing again a response here, that the car bombings in the cities are possibly in response to the U.S. offensive today, again, Operation Matador, airstrikes again in Iraq and at the Syrian border, heading up the Euphrates, where villages have, we understand, been hit.
Well, you're exactly right. It's another consistent pattern if we look back at all of the major U.S. military operations in occupied Iraq, including both sieges of Fallujah, including the assaults on Sadr City and Najaf by the U.S. military against Muqtada al-Sadr, the Shia cleric who had called the two intifadas against the occupation forces. Similar things have happened in Ramadi and Samarra, Bakuba, and now on a larger scale up in Al-Qaim, where we have, again, as a response to major military operations, we have extreme attacks throughout the rest of the country, and this has been very consistent. And once again, if there were indeed a large number of fighters there, again, like in Fallujah, same with Al-Qaim, is they have left, most of them have left in advance, and obviously we see major resistance operations being carried out as a direct result to this heavy-handed practice of using military might in Iraq, and consistently this has been the pattern throughout the entire occupation, and as a result we see massive numbers of Iraqi security personnel and civilians being killed.
And England's Tony Blair, America's George Bush, Iraq's interim leader Ayad Alawi, all being criticized for, again, the relentless attacks on Fallujah that did kill so many civilians. That seems to have resulted in a big loss of support for occupation forces in Iraq. So how do you think, Dar Jamail, that the U.S. military intends this operation to work? It seems they've already seen evidence that this kind of heavy-handed attack, we might say, makes things worse.
Well, you know, Dory, that is the million-dollar question. I really wish I had an answer. It has been a consistent pattern that has really left me baffled since I first started reporting about Iraq in November of 2003. Time after time, we see these huge military operations going in, causing huge loss of life, massive property damage, and then the ensuing result of just spreading the resistance and pushing more people into joining the resistance and infuriating even more Iraqis against the occupation forces. It is a completely failed policy, but it goes on back all the way to Bush foreign policy, where they use aggression rather than diplomacy, and this is what we see being played out on the ground, and we see the ramifications coming around extremely quickly, where all it does is turn more people against the U.S. Policy there in Iraq and what they are trying to accomplish, and causes more chaos and death throughout the whole country, and now it is starting to bleed out into neighboring countries as well, as far as causing massive refugee crises, as well as turning other people in surrounding countries to Iraq, like Jordan and Egypt, Syria, and even in Lebanon, against U.S. policy here, because it is affecting the whole region now in a very negative way.
I want to call your attention to a BBC World News report early this morning in which it was suggested that weapons were coming from Syria. The decision was made by this reporter to press for information about weapons coming from Syria in spite of the fact that his guest that he was interviewing continued to say that there was no evidence for that. Are you hearing anything about that rationale for this latest operation on the part of the Americans?
Well, again, as you said, that is a very unfounded comment. There's no facts on the ground to back that up, that weapons have been coming in from Syria. Even the military hasn't commented on that. What is quite clear here, even in Jordan, is that, ironically, Jordan, supposedly being an ally of the U.S. and gets hundreds of millions of dollars every year from the U.S. government, and now is asking and receiving more in order to step up their quote-unquote fight against terrorism. And the great irony is that actually most of the arms, fighters, and money is coming through Saudi Arabia and Jordan, specifically, two supposed allies of the U.S. And while it wouldn't surprise me that some arms and fighters and funding is coming through both Syria and Iran, certainly the brunt are coming through the supposed states which are allies of the U.S.
Dar, talk a little bit about the fact that intelligence reports are being cited. Again, U.S. media saying U.S. intelligence is showing al-Zarqawi followers took refuge in the remote desert region of Anbar province after losses in Iraqi cities. Again, kind of begging the question of if they took refuge in Anbar province, how are they managing to accomplish attacks in other parts of the country?
Well, again, there's really, these are myths being propagated by the U.S. military and then re-announced by mainstream media in the U.S. where there is no solid proof. There has been no investigation by any journalists working through these networks as to if this person really exists at all and if what is their proof. They're simply taking what the military says and repeating it. They are not investigating this. They are not questioning the military. They are not pushing them to provide proof of this, whether it be audio tape or videotape or satellite imagery or anything. There is yet to be one single bit of evidence, hard evidence, provided by the military other than them simply stating, yes, this person is here, no, now he moved to Mosul, no, now he's in the western desert of Iraq. And again, there really is no proof that this person is there and is carrying out these operations and leading them, other than writings on a website now and then.
And so where he goes, the U.S. military airstrikes may well follow. One question I do have, too, is about...
Yes,
go ahead.
I would certainly propose that again, going back to the consistent pattern that I've seen, is that it could easily be argued that this person is simply being used by the U.S. military to provide a justification for a huge operation that they're about to carry out on a particular area. And if we watch this pattern, even following the story with what's happening at the Syrian border, Zarqawi will somehow mysteriously fade into the background and his name won't be mentioned for a while. And then watch what happens next time there's going to be another major military operation in Iraq. I would be very surprised if his name is pulled out yet again to justify yet another attack.
We're talking about Abu Musab al-Zarqawi. He's been described as someone with ties to al-Qaeda. He's been described as the most wanted terrorist in Iraq today. What do you know of the possibility of al-Qaeda being in Iraq, Dar Jamil?
Well, again, it's a situation with this individual and al-Qaeda where there hasn't been any hard evidence provided by the U.S. military or the U.S. government about this. It's simply a situation where if we really look at the position that the Bush administration is now in with Iraq, it does not look good in the media for them to have to state, yes, we are fighting Iraqis, because supposedly these are the people that are liberated, these are the people that have the new successful democracy, and it certainly isn't going to look good if they admit that, no, actually the vast majority of the people that they're fighting in Iraq are Iraqis themselves who have lost loved ones and had loved ones detained or humiliated under the occupation. Even if we look at the U.S. military, according to the U.S. Marines intelligence, in Fallujah, as a result of the November siege, there were only a total of 35 foreign fighters killed there. That out of them claiming that they killed 1,200 fighters. So even in Fallujah, which was supposedly being controlled mostly by foreign fighters and Saddam loyalists and this sort of thing, again, time and time again, I've seen this proved debunked, and it's really nothing but a propaganda attempt being used by the Pentagon to win the information war in Iraq by portraying anyone who stands up to fight for their country, even if it's for nationalistic reasons or for revenge, portraying these people as terrorists, which, of course, any empire through history has done. Anyone who opposes their rule or opposes them taking over a country is, of course, labeled a terrorist. And if we put the shoe on the other foot, we simply look at the fact of how America was founded, and in our history books, we don't read about the people who fought against the British as being terrorists. We refer to them as patriots, and many people in Iraq now refer to the Iraqi resistance as patriots.
The view, again, is that America should leave. There's also talk of partition. Talk about the politics a little bit in terms of the Sunni, Kurd, and Shiite issues that are going on today.
It's another situation that doesn't get the in-depth coverage that it really deserves. If we look at the fact, first of all, that mainstream media continues to focus on this government in Iraq as if it is the government, the reality is this is another temporary slash interim type of government. They only just last week finished appointing enough seats to have a functioning government, and their sole task now is to author a constitution, and the due date for that is August 15th, so we're already now in May, so we're just a few months away that we have these competing groups, the Kurds, Sunni, and Shia being the primary groups, where they have to agree on a constitution, which is really a monumental task because, for example, the Kurds will want autonomy. They will want Kirkuk as part of a more autonomous Kurdistan, and they are unrelenting in their calls for having Kirkuk, and that is in direct contradiction to what the Shia want and the Sunni. They do not want Kirkuk to be controlled solely by the Kurds. And then we have the Shia who so many of them want to have an Islamic State, which is, in, of course, in direct contradiction to Kurdish and Sunni wishes where they want it to be secular. So these are very difficult conflicts that these people are going to have to try to work out in just a three-month period. And then another thing that needs to be noted is if these differences are not able to be worked through and this constitution is not finished by August 15th for a vote, then that means the real elections, which are scheduled to be held on December 15th later this year, will not occur, and all of this will start over. We will have a new vote for a new National Assembly, and then they'll try again. So we are, in effect, again, in a situation where the government is, in a sense, a lame duck government, if you will, and really this challenge of authoring a constitution seems to be a very, very difficult one and not likely one that is going to be successful. So I think it's important that people keep in mind that this is a very temporary situation, and any real resolution to this situation is still really not quite on the horizon.
Dar, I want to remind you of what you wrote with Jonathan Steele on April 27th, 2005. This appeared in The Guardian. And I'd like to quote just a few short paragraphs here where you and Steele write, two U.S. attempts were made to destroy Fallujah, a symbol of defiance last year. The first in April fizzled out after Iraqi politicians, including many who supported the invasion of their country, condemned the use of airstrikes to terrorize an entire city. The Americans called off the attack, but not before hundreds of families fled and more than 600 people had been killed. 6 months later, the Americans tried again. This time, Washington's allies had been talked to in advance. Consistent U.S. propaganda about the presence in Fallujah of a top al-Qaeda figure, Abu Musab al-Zarqawi, was used to create a climate of acquiescence and the U.S. appointed Iraqi government. Shiite leaders were told that bringing Fallujah under control was the only way to prevent a Sunni-inspired civil war. Now, some months later, Dar Jamail, are we headed in the direction of civil war? And what else can you tell us about the way the new leaders emerging in Iraq are being sort of manipulated into doing or supporting U.S. policies and military policies specifically?
Many, many Iraqis, I can't tell you how many I've talked to about this civil war threat, feel that it has been U.S. attempts and sanctioned, essentially, and helped carried out by most mainstream Western media outlets of deliberately attempting to provoke a civil war because it would behoove their interest to have a continuing instability in Iraq. And if we look at this played out on the ground, there have been some very large events lately happened. For example, the situation in Madain, just south of Baghdad, where supposedly so many Shia were kidnapped and then killed, and they were saying that it was 100. This was even a myth propagated by the Iraqi government, by Talabani, saying, yes, this is very critical. It was Sunnis that did this. There's been no proof. And then bodies were found in the Euphrates River, but in fact, there were bodies that were months old and had nothing to do with what happened in Madain. And a deliberate and very dangerous attempt to spark a civil war, which failed. And then there have been all of these bombings at Shia mosques. No one really knows for sure who is behind these. And again, it is a critical situation, and many people are concerned about it. But at the same time, most Iraqis I speak with on the ground really feel, especially regarding the Shia-Sunni sectarian conflict, if there is one, they feel that this is simply not going to be the spark of a civil war. And we see these external influences, which so many people believe they are external, even the some of the political and religious leaders of some of these mosques who have been bombed are very, very reluctant to say that there were Sunnis behind this. Only a few politicians and a few of the religious leaders, particularly the Shia, have come out and actually even blame the Sunnis themselves. So, but amongst the common people, this is really, it doesn't appear that people feel there will be a civil war. Keeping in mind the fact that some of the larger tribes in Iraq are both Shia and Sunni, we have so many intermixed marriages. So if there is going to be a civil war, it seems like it would most likely be more along ethnic lines rather than sectarian lines, and the spark may well be what happens about Kirkuk. Kirkuk is, of course, a very oil-rich region, the most oil-rich region in Iraq outside of the south, or along with the south, down near Basra and Umm Qasr, where the oil fields are. In Kirkuk, there is a refinery, and, of course, the Kurds are very already taking very large strides, including it in a more independent Kurdistan. They are pushing to have a referendum vote, which will come up this fall. They are already going around and taking down all of the signs in Arabic from government buildings there and replacing them with Kurdish signs written in Kurdish. Arabic is not being taught in the schools there any longer. Peshmerga, the Kurdish militia, is basically now in control of the city. It could be argued that the beginnings of a sort of ethnic cleansing are already occurring there. So this is a very worrisome situation because what does happen in Kirkuk may well spark a civil war, and not just with Kurds against Sunni, for example, but there are Turkmen there as well as many, many Shia, many people who are followers of Muqtada al-Sadr. So this is going to be a very volatile situation, one that certainly demands our attention, especially in the next coming months and in early fall when the referendum vote for Kirkuk will occur.
Antonia Juhas has been reporting and writing about one of the leading political figures in Iraq who has now become a vice president. His name is Adil Abdel Mahdi. And one of the things that Juhas was talking about was his press conference at the National Press Club in Washington, D.C., where he said a privatization plan for Iraq's oil would benefit the U.S. and major oil companies. Now, noting again that it's my understanding Mahdi has deep ties with both the Iraq National Congress, which, as we know, came into Iraq with Ahmed Shalabi, and also with the Kurds. Tell us what you know about these types of new power structures that are developing in Iraq today.
Well, just to note, follow up on what you said and note maybe one other, it is a very corrupt government, and it's very, very clear this is a puppet regime, and their strings are being pulled completely by the U.S. government. Mahdi, in particular, he is in support of the privatization of Iraq's oil, which is in, of course, direct contradiction with the people, the predominant number of Shia people who did come out and vote on January 30. They voted because they don't want privatization of Iraq's resources, and they voted because they wanted a timetable for withdrawal. This is even evidenced by the fact that just yesterday in Karbala, there was a very large demonstration of people, and one of their main demands was they were wanting their political representatives to call for a timetable for U.S. withdrawal. So consistently we're seeing this puppet regime not respect the wishes and the will of the people who put it in power. And then we have another instance I should cite is Ahmed Shalabi. We have this individual who provided some of the false reasons for the U.S. to go to war, gave faulty intelligence time and time again. This came out even in the mainstream media. This is a person who has been wanted in Jordan for a long time for bank fraud, for tens of millions of dollars of bank fraud. And now this person is the temporary acting minister of oil in Iraq. And then even just yesterday, again, most likely because there's been some string pulling in the background yet again, but King Abdullah here in Jordan actually decided to pardon Ahmed Shalabi for millions of dollars of bank fraud, because simply it does not look good to have a U.S.-backed, supposedly elected representative in Iraq wanted basically the situation with Shalabi is if he drives into Jordan, he would be immediately arrested and put in jail. So this man has now since been pardoned, and now he sits in the Iraqi government. It is corrupt through and through. We don't have a government who's acting autonomously whatsoever, and they simply don't have the power to do so because the U.S. is not allowing them to have the power, because if they did, they would call for an immediate timetable for withdrawal. And this is another instance why we saw Mr. Rumsfeld fly over to Iraq just days after the election on January 30th, and he came over before the actual results of the election were released, but also to talk with different politicians, making it very clear that they would not have the autonomy to ask for a timetable for withdrawal from the U.S. government.
Dar, let's end by noting that Hoshyar Zebari has also been named foreign minister of Iraq. According to a CBS report, he belongs to a powerful Kurdish tribe in northwest Iraq. He's the uncle of Massoud Barzani, one of two leaders in control of the Kurdish region of Iraq. And as the country's first Kurdish foreign minister, Zebari was a guerrilla fighter during Kurdish rebellions against Saddam Hussein.
It's becoming almost reflective of what's happened in Afghanistan, where the U.S. isn't really interested in rebuilding the country or really bring true security there or really improve the lives of the people. Instead, they have turned Afghanistan largely under the control of warlords. Same thing is happening in Iraq. It's evident that the U.S. does not have control of the situation. They are desperate. They are appointing anyone who they can find at that moment who might act as a good spokesperson for them and carry out their policy on the ground. And one thing to note also is overall these appointments generally don't last real long, and these people end up very, very quickly losing the support of the populace in Iraq, just as Mr. Ayed Alawi has. This person is loathed by so many people in Iraq, and this is why we see even now in the National Assembly he really doesn't have much of a position of power. And I imagine a similar thing will happen to the people you just mentioned.
Journalist Dar Jamail. His reports from Iraq can be viewed at darjamailiraq.com. www.thepublicvoice.com. Tune in tomorrow, Thursday at 5 p.m., and that's the 12th of May, for part two of this discussion. We'll be filling in for Richard Sherman, host of WHUS's From a Distant Shore, as he's out of town. I'm Dori Smith. This program was produced in the studios of listener-supported WHUS Stores, radio for the people at the University of Connecticut. For further information, write to me at theshockvote@yahoo.com. The views and opinions expressed on this program do not necessarily reflect those of this station, its management, or the University of Connecticut.